morning in the last case, U.S. versus Brunel.
Good afternoon. I see I'm at the back of the parade here. Counsel.
Fortunately, not a long parade today. It was only 4:15.
The district court abused its discretion in denying Larry Purnell a 15-month reduction in his sentence based on the amended crack guidelines. The court never even addressed or considered, on the one hand, the important reasons why crack sentences were being reduced, the discriminatory impact over a long period of time of excessive crack sentencing. And in exercising discretion, there must be a judgment, a comparison between two factors. You have the important reasons for remedial adjustment to his sentence, and then a statutorily directed set of considerations on what under 3582 can be considered, which is the 3553A factors, danger to the community, and post-conviction conduct may be considered. Although on post-conviction conduct, the judge specifically says at page 8 of the appendix that she didn't intend to think about that. So there's a brief reference by the government in the initial motion to the fact that he had some infractions while he was in prison, that he was insolent, but that was not really pursued, and I don't think the court relied on that, nor the government. So the only thing that the government argued for, and the only reason given to oppose the 15-month reduction, was his litigation conduct in a matter which is now before this court in a separate appeal. And in this, he alleges a variety of things, that he was coerced into entering into the plea agreement. All his objections and all of his filings all go to the gun count, not to the crack offense.
Mr. Morris, what mandatory minimum was the defendant facing originally with and without the 851 information? Can you help tell me with that?
I don't know. Maybe Mr. Heisted knows. I know that it's not an issue in terms of whether or not the reduction could be granted. He's still at over 10 years.
Did he get a discount for acceptance of responsibility?
Yes, he did.
Okay. I frankly find it a little difficult to see acceptance of responsibility being given. He gets the with the appellate waiver, the 2255 waiver, and then as soon as the district court can't change the sentence anymore, he's reneging and backing away from what he's admitted.
Well, he is entitled to attack his plea and sentence if he was coerced into entering into the plea agreement, which is what he alleges. And there's never been a hearing or any opportunity for him. He's never had counsel. He's simply asserting this. And I don't think that would be a violation of his plea agreement if he were, in fact, coerced. But there's no way to suggest that his pro se litigation was other than disruptive, and it was certainly irritating to the court.
And the court found that at least parts of it were false, that false assertions were being made by Mr. Purnell.
That's true, although, I mean, there was no opportunity for him to respond to those. It's simply a conclusion that he wasn't coerced. He says, I was coerced, and here's what happened. He says the evidence was falsified. The judge says, no, that's not what happened. The government says, no, that's not what happened. You know, and all of those matters are now before this court in another appeal. So what's happened here is that he's been denied these 15 months as a punishment for the way in which he behaved. Now, I mean, one of the great things about our country is under the Constitution, people have rights to exercise. They can file pleadings.
Not false ones.
No, I agree.
That's the troubling part of this, that the judge who had the guilty plea has assessed those allegations to be false.
But I agree that was the judge's view and that they were false. But But none of the other important 3553A factors that the judge should have considered were even mentioned. They weren't advanced by the government, and they weren't considered by the court. So this litigation, pro se litigation, goes to his character, for honesty, for integrity, for honoring his agreements. But everything else is basically ignored. The nature and circumstances of the offense, nothing is said by the government, and the court doesn't consider that. Whether this reduced sentence would be an appropriate sentence under 3553. His criminal history, the government mentions this in its appellate brief, but it's not an issue before the court. Does he have, and all of those factors were considered by the court at the original sentencing and can't be revisited under a 3582 proceeding. It's not a full resentencing. So that wasn't a reason to not give him the reduction that he was eligible for. There's no dispute he was eligible for it. Would 123 months as opposed to 138 reflect the seriousness of his offense? Would it be a just punishment? Would it promote respect for the law? Nothing said by the government about those things. Nothing said by the court in deciding to deny him. As to deterrence, there's one mention of the word by the government in the argument, but it's not pursued as a... And in fact, deterrence is actually spoken of as if this will teach somebody not to file this kind of stuff, not to be, you know, barraging the court with improper motions and pleadings, which were all, by the way, just summarily dismissed. They were one-sentence dismissals. The court simply said, denied, denied, denied. Protection of the public from further crimes, clearly an important factor in exercising this discretion. No consideration, no argument made by the government that 123 months wouldn't be a sufficient sentence. Education, vocational training, and treatment. Nobody ever fusses about that. It's in 3553. Most importantly, no discussion that 123 months wouldn't be a sufficient and not greater than necessary sentence. So this, and of course, all the factors not raised or considered by the court cannot be a basis for supporting the judgment that the judge made in this case under Wallace. I see my lights on. Normally nothing changes between the time of the application for reduction and the initial sentence. So most 3553A factors aren't really at issue because the guy's been in prison. So there's nothing much. There are situations where there's violence in prison. There's some, and that would be a good reason to deny a reduction, but that's not the case with him. He'd actually pursued a series of courses in prison, and the judge acknowledged that was a good thing. So this is a situation where, for really improper reasons, he's losing the benefit of a reduction that would put his sentence in line with what the Fair Sentencing Act says is a just sentence for him. I'll reserve the rest of my time if there's no questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Cliff Heistead, and I represent the United States in this case. Mr. Purnell's argument is essentially that a United States District Court judge bore such a grudge against him that she deprived him of something to which he was legally entitled. This argument, Your Honors, should be rejected. First of all, obviously the District Court did not have a grudge against Mr. Purnell. Even though she was not obligated to do so, she appointed counsel for him at his request to pursue the crack reduction motion. Even though she was not obligated to do so by the law, she granted a hearing for counsel to come forward and make the arguments that he made. Second, defendants are not automatically entitled to the crack reductions. First, as we know, there must be a consideration of the 3553A factors, and even then, judges may but are by no means compelled to come to the conclusion that the defendant wishes them to come to. And third, and most importantly for the purposes of this proceeding, the court based its decision not to grant the sentencing reduction on the history and characteristics of Larry Purnell. That was not only entirely appropriate, that was required under 3553A that she do this. And the district court by no means abused its discretion by denying this motion. Now, perhaps a little bit of history here, and this will go to one of the questions that was raised. If Mr. Purnell had proceeded to trial and lost, He had faced a mandatory minimum, of 300 months in prison. But due to the government's dismissal of counts 3 and 4 of the indictment, due to the government's refraining from filing an 851 notice of intention to enhance the sentence, his mandatory minimum sentence was reduced from 300 months down to 120 months, less than half. And at the sentencing hearing, the district court sentenced him to 78 months, which was low end of the guidelines for the crack offense, and the mandatory required 60 months on the 924C.
Okay, so with the 851 and counts 3 and 4, you would have had a 20-year mandatory minimum?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And
plus the 5 for the 924C.
Right. And then, so how did you take it down? I'm not sure we've got the full record from the original case in front of us yet, but how did it go down to 60 months on the cocaine itself?
Because counts 3 and 4, which contained crack offenses that were larger, that would have brought him over the 50 grams, were dismissed.
Okay.
They were counted for guideline purposes, but the mandatory minimums attached to them no longer were in play.
Okay, so he's just subject to the 5.
It would have been the 5.
5 year.
Doubled if we had filed the 851 to 10. Now, despite Mr. Purnell's promise not to appeal or seek collateral review of his sentence, he began to promptly file these frivolous motions, which, let's not be mistaken, they did, in fact, contain false statements. At the plea hearing, Larry Purnell admitted to the court under oath that he possessed a gun, a Ruger 45 caliber pistol with a serial number that was identified, and two times under oath, he said that he possessed that gun. Now, no sooner had he been sentenced that he began to file motions where he denied, flatly denied
ever
having.
The gun had been displayed to an agent, an undercover agent? Had
absolutely, Your Honor. The gun had been shown to an undercover federal agent who was wearing a recording device at the time and made a recording of the serial number of the gun as he held and handled the weapon.
He didn't find that suspicious.
Well, hopefully he was.
Did the agent recite the serial number on
the
tape?
It was whispered, Your Honor. But a good record was made that there's no doubt that there was a gun.
The agent knows the difference between a BB gun and an actual 45, I assume, or
he's an agent with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms.
Okay.
He knows a 45 caliber pistol when he sees one.
If he doesn't, he better look for new work.
And along the way, despite his promises in the plea agreement, he filed notices of appeal. Despite his promise not to appeal, he filed a 2255 petition. And this is important because Mr. Morris just pointed out that Mr. Purnell has had no opportunity to test whether or not he actually possessed the gun, but that's not true. There was a 2255 petition that he filed, the government responded to, and the district court ruled specifically that she credited his sworn testimony at the change of plea hearing that he had a pistol and that his claims to the contrary, therefore, and that she was entitled to rely on those, as she was, as Seventh Circuit precedent allows. Therefore, by definition, his claims in the 2255 petition and in several subsequent petitions were therefore false.
Mr. Heistad, let me just get my concern out on the table here. I'm troubled about, I guess, the scope of the ruling you might be asking us to make in this case. We see a lot of cases in which prisoners are pursuing various forms of litigation, grievances about the way they're being treated and so on. And if a prisoner comes in and alleges, I filed grievances, I filed lawsuits, and then the people who are the targets of those grievances retaliated against me, we recognize First Amendment claims in those circumstances. How is this case different from that kind of a scenario? Retaliation for the exercise of or the right of access to courts?
The retaliation aspect of this was never raised in any pleading but this one. All along, Mr. Purnell has he's not been saying necessarily, the issue before this court, as I see it, is did the district court abuse its discretion by considering the 3553A factors, the history and characteristics of Mr. Purnell, when denying discretionary relief to him?
Let me frame the question a little bit differently then. Let's suppose we have a defendant seeking 3582 relief, and the district judge also happens to have a civil case brought by that person challenging conditions of confinement, treatment, whether it's health or use of excessive force in prison or so on. Could the district judge take that into account in denying relief?
I think the difference between your case and this case is we know that Mr. Purnell's claims are false by his own sworn testimony during the plea agreement, during the plea hearing. That's how I would distinguish your case. I understand the concern of those prisoners as voiced by you just now, but in this case, Mr. Purnell stood before the judge and said, I held that gun, and we know for a fact that he did.
So there was some reference to perhaps an evaluation of his psychiatric status?
I believe that was an offhand comment that Mr. Morris made at the crack reduction. There has never been any question about his competence. As to the issue of whether or not 3553 was, in fact, considered, I've explained that history and characteristics in this case is the most important, I believe, of those. And clearly it was. But I just want to clear up the misconception here. 3553A was front and center in the district judge's decision. The claim that nobody raised it in pleadings before the hearing, that nobody raised it during the hearing, that it was not raised after the hearing, that's just simply not true. In the government's pleading before the January 30th, 2012 hearing, we made it very clear that the decision should be made under 3553A and those factors. And during the argument, you've read the transcript attached to the brief, there are multiple references by the court and by myself, and I believe also by Mr. Morris, where we acknowledge that 3553A should be the guiding principle, and where just punishment and adequate deterrence and these factors were raised, and I advance these as arguments why the reduction should be dismissed. And the district court expressly stated, both on the record and later again in her written order, that she was looking at the false statements and the conduct of Mr. Purnell when denying his reduction motion. And for all of these reasons, because 3553A was an adequate and required basis and was fully thought out and deliberated upon and used as the correct justification for this, we ask that you affirm the finding of the district court and reject the defendant's argument. Thank you.
Now, Mike, you have 2 minutes, counsel.
The problem with relying on the change of plea colloquy is that he says he was coerced into doing that. Now, I think he's using the word coerced as a layperson word. I think he was under huge pressure. He had to make a decision. He couldn't solve his drug offense and the threat of an 851 unless he was told to do what all defense lawyers say, which is, you know, if you have any reservations, let's talk about them, but you better answer the judge's questions and answer them in the affirmative, or there isn't going to be a change of plea. He had a lot of pressure on him, and he felt coerced, I think, in that sense. And that makes his statements there the very ones that he's attacking in his 2255, that he was pressured into it. Whether that succeeds or fails is another matter. But it does go to the question of at what point has he got to be careful about exercising his rights because he's gonna lose this some fairly minor reduction. It's only 11% reduction in his aggregate sentence. As to history and characteristics, history was not discussed. Saying the referencing the statute 3553A doesn't involve a discussion or a consideration of the factors, and it just didn't happen. The transcript speaks to that, and I won't labor that. I think he was being punished because he was, and I concede this, an extremely tiresome, difficult guy who's filed over and over again the same pleading, and it irritated the government and it irritated the court. And it would have irritated me if I was in those shoes. But the overwhelming importance of setting right these excessive crack sentences that have people locked up for decades, for extra time, over a period of a decade, these are being imposed. There's tens of thousands of people who receive this. There's a disparity if you take it away from this guy just because he happens to be an atrocious jailhouse lawyer who seems to have no restraint in what he imagines happened. And I don't think that's an appropriate punishment. And that's not what deterrence is about. That's not what the term means here. It was wrong not to give it to him.
Mr. Morris, you took this case by appointment, didn't you?
I did, Judge.
Again, as we have earlier in the day, we thank you for your fine representation of your client.
Thank you.
And hope to